This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Johanna Fernandez about Mumia Abu-Jamal's recent day in court.
What's happening could be a way for Mumia, after 37 years, to finally get out of prison.
We'll also look into the causes and the responses to the recent acts of violence that claimed the lives of 13 innocent Jews in a Pittsburgh synagogue.
It's Trump's white nationalism that underscores all of it. The bombs sent to Democrats. It's all because of the kind of atmosphere that Trump consistently stirred up every day.
We'll look at how the state of Pennsylvania beat gerrymandering and how other states can do the same.
That's the subtitle of Jim Lieber's new book, Victory. He'll be our guest today.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Mumia Abu-Jamal is the country's most famous political prisoner. He was sentenced to death for the 1981 killing of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. The case was riddled with constitutional violations, and his sentence was later commuted to life in prison without possibility of parole. Recently, in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Williams v. Pennsylvania, Mumia's attorneys have argued that his rights were violated after former District Attorney Ron Castile failed to recuse himself in an appeals decision. At the time, Castile was a state Supreme Court judge. Now, Judge Leon Tucker asked the Philadelphia DA's office to produce an internal memo that might reveal that Castile, back when he was city DA, had direct involvement in pursuing Abu-Jamal's death sentence. If he did, his later denial as a Supreme Court justice of Abu-Jamal's appeal could be deemed biased. Defense attorney Judy Ritter said, quote, "Justice Castile has shown himself to be involved in this case, to be biased against a certain class of cases that our client falls into." The Commonwealth argued that as district attorney, Castile was simply doing his job. Emotions ran high, both inside and outside the courtroom. Maureen Faulkner, the widow of Daniel Faulkner, stood up and cried in the middle of court proceedings when the judge announced that both sides would have to wait until December for any closure in the case. Joining us today is Professor Johanna Fernandez of Baruch College. She is also with the campaign to bring Mumia home. Johanna, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me, Heidi.
The U.S. Supreme Court case of Williams v. Pennsylvania opened the possibility of a new trial for Mumia. Can you briefly explain what that case held and what last week's day in court meant?
Well, in Williams v. Pennsylvania, the Supreme Court ruled that a prosecutor who has been personally and directly involved in prosecuting a case cannot later, when the prosecutor becomes judge, sit and hear arguments on that same case. So this is a very important case, the first of its kind, that establishes the rules of judicial bias. So a prosecutor cannot also be the judge in a case that he has previously prosecuted.
Now, I understand that there was a memo that the district attorney was called on to produce that might have indicated that the former prosecutor, Ron Castile, might have had direct involvement in pursuing Mumia's death sentence.
Ronald Castile was district attorney of Pennsylvania from 1986 to 1991. Later, he became a member of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And it is our claim, Mumia's attorney's claims, that Ronald Castile prosecuted Mumia's case personally and directly, and later denied all of Mumia's appeals when Mumia presented very long list of violations in his original trial. what has surfaced is a memo written to Ron Castillo by his assistant. And that memo doesn't say much, but Mumia's name appears in the response that his assistant, the deputy DA of Philadelphia, whose last name is Bertold, wrote to in response to Ronald Castillo. That original request on the part of Ronald Castillo to his deputy DA is missing. And we have been asking the DA's office currently to find or produce that file. And we believe that the original memo would, Ronald Castillo was interested and directly involved in the prosecution of Mumia, but also in calling for his execution. About 3 months ago, when this issue was going to be heard in the courts, another memo surfaced. And this is perhaps a more important memo. And that is a memo written to Michael Fisher, who was at that point the Pennsylvania state senator, a Republican Pennsylvania state senator. And that memo written to Michael Fisher essentially identified a list of 9 death row inmates who the DA's office under Ronald Castillo essentially argued should certainly be executed. And part of what was presented in last week's hearing was evidence suggesting that this memo written to Michael Fisher from Ron Castillo's office suggests that the DA, Castillo, had a direct and personal involvement in the prosecution of Mumia's case. Unfortunately, we have also another missing memo. We don't have the original letter written by Michael Fisher to Castillo. We only have Castillo's response to Michael Fisher. But what we presented in court last week, Mumia's attorneys, that is that the correspondence between Senator Michael Fisher and Ron Castillo revolved around Senate Bill 956, which at that point was being presented and was up for a vote as a means of getting around the important Supreme Court decision, Mills versus Pennsylvania. And in that decision, the Supreme Court held it was unconstitutional for the court to give jury poor instructions in a death penalty case that would not allow the jurors to consider mitigating evidence against sending a prisoner to his death.
Johanna, in the courtroom last week, how did the government respond to the issue of the missing memos?
The government was stumped. The prosecutor was stumped. And at some point, the judge asked the prosecutor, well, do you agree that if the memos were missing and are missing and can't be found, the defense attorneys have an argument that they should be granted relief on the basis of adverse inference? The prosecutor said yes. Adverse inference is essentially a precedent that establishes that a government office cannot produce files. The person who's registering a claim should not be adversely affected by the fact that the files were missing.
Got it.
In this case, Mumia would be granted relief on the Williams issue.
Okay, thanks.
Johanna, when last I was at a demonstration in support of Mumia in Philadelphia, there was a huge police presence. In fact, there were a bunch of them revving up their engines on their Harley-Davidson motorcycles. I understand the cops were in the courthouse on the day of the hearing. Talk about the Fraternal Order of Police and what it was like in the courthouse with the police there.
In the last three hearings, the police has been present in a significant way, and they've essentially accompanied the widow, Daniel Faulkner, who's the police officer who was killed at the scene of the crime. Three hearings ago, Maureen Faulkner started showing up. I imagine that she started showing up alongside the police because they are threatened. They must have thought that this issue was going to be immediately dismissed when it was first heard, but we've been now in court for a year and a half. The presence of the police is overwhelming, and it's had a chilling effect on the judge, but also the people of the city of Philadelphia who want to be present at the hearing. They essentially get in before the courtroom opens. And when the courtroom is open to allow the people of the city of Philadelphia in, more than half the seats are taken by the police and by those escorting the widow, Maureen Faulkner.
What happens now, between now and the new December court date? I mean, is there a chance that this is an avenue for Mumia to get a new trial and we can get him out of prison?
Absolutely. So the issue that is being litigated at this moment is the question of whether his appeals hearing before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court was just and constitutional. If he gets relief on the Williams issue, that appeals process will be opened up. And Mumia presented something like 20 violations to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. So he will be able to present once again the 20 violations that were denied. And that will open up the possibility of a new trial. It will certainly, in this atmosphere in which the courts and the criminal justice system is under the microscope because of the Black Lives Matter movement and because there's been a shift in consciousness, it is almost certain that he will gain relief in at least one of those issues and get a new trial.
Well, Johanna, thank you so much for this update, and we hope in a little over a month's time to talk with you again about what happens back in the courtroom.
And how can people learn more about the Mumia case?
Well, you can visit bringmumiahome.com, www.bringmumiahome.com, or you can email us at bringmumiahome@gmail.com.
Great. Johanna Fernandez, thank you so much for all you do in support of Mumia and for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for your work.
The slaughter of 11 elderly Jews praying in a Pittsburgh synagogue last week has unsettled all of us and shown that anti-Semitism, given the right economic conditions and the right racist culture, can rear its ugly head yet again. Just as in Germany in the 1930s when Hitler rose to power by playing up fear and scapegoating minorities, we see here in the USA President Donald Trump scapegoating immigrants, Muslims, and globalists, which is his code word for Jews. The outpouring of solidarity with the Jewish community in Pittsburgh has been phenomenal. We speak today with Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she works on anti-war, U.S. foreign policy, and Palestinian rights issues. She's also a member of the board of Jewish Voice for Peace and has recently written an article for The Nation, along with Reverend William Barber, on the situation in Pittsburgh. She's also co-written an article in The Nation, along with Reverend William Barber, entitled, In Response to Pittsburgh, We Must Come Together as One. Phyllis Bennis, Welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
The article that you wrote with Reverend Barber in The Nation was really terrific. And if you could talk about that for a bit, I'd appreciate it. But I wanted to ask you, what kind of solidarity has been manifested in support of the people's families and the victims in Pittsburgh?
You know, it's been a really extraordinary thing to see. It's been very visible and very, I would say, very powerful. That we've seen it before, but this time it's, you know, each time one of these horrifying things happens, it builds. The intersectionality and the solidarity builds. And this time it was everything from the people who came out in Pittsburgh, from the whole community, African Americans and Muslims and, you know, just everybody came out to mourn, to express outrage. When Trump tried to sort of divert all of that into a focus on him, as he so often does.
And always does.
and insisted on going to Pittsburgh, even though the mayor of Pittsburgh had asked him not to, leaders of the Jewish community had urged him not to, and he didn't listen to anybody. He went anyway. There were thousands of people out in the streets, all kinds of people, Jews, non-Jews, everybody was out to say, no, this is not about you, this is about the victims, including people who felt that Trump's rhetoric, of course, has been a key component of all this. But we've seen an amazing rise in this kind of solidarity. A number of Muslim organizations, both in Pittsburgh and nationally, immediately launched a campaign to raise money to help pay for funerals and to help pay for whatever the needs are of these of the families of the 11 victims. And their goal was to raise $25,000, and they raised that within just a couple of hours. So they raised their goal. Can we reach $75,000? And when I had checked, it was about 3 hours later, they were already up above $60,000. So it's that kind of, shall we say, intersectional solidarity that we're seeing at such a powerful level that's been really inspiring.
Now, Phyllis, on the opposite end of the spectrum, we have a response from the Israeli government taking a nationalistic turn. Can you discuss that?
Yeah. Once again, very much like what Trump did, the Israelis are trying to make this all about Israel. Everything from the position of the Trump administration to invite the Israeli ambassador, Ron Dermer, to travel with the president on Air Force One to Pittsburgh. He was the first one off the plane to welcome the president to Pittsburgh, as if it had anything to do with Israel. This had nothing to do with Israel. These victims were targeted. The synagogue was targeted, number one, because they were Jews, and this was straight-up, old-fashioned, violent anti-Semitism, and number two, because this particular synagogue, like so many others, had been involved in supporting the work of Hayas, one of the really important refugee rights organizations that operates in the U.S., that began back in the 1880s as an organization bringing Jewish refugees who were fleeing the pogroms in Russia and in Eastern Europe in that period, helping them come to the U.S., helping them find lives here, helping them adapt, learn English, all those things. And later, in the more recent period, they've been involved in supporting refugees from Central America, from Syria, from all over the world. They're one of the largest and really most important and very, very principled organizations working on refugee rights across the United States. And they have been targeted by the Trump administration, they've been mentioned, and then you have this anti-Semite who wrote about Hayas in his social media accounts, including just hours before he committed his rampage and murdered people. He wrote on social media that Hayas, which used to stand for Hebrew Immigrants Aid Society, that Hayas was responsible for the caravan of Central Americans desperate enough to try to walk across Central America and north through Mexico to reach the U.S. border to present themselves for the possibility of asylum, precisely what U.S. law requires them to do. You know, it's a complete falsehood. I'm diverting a bit here, but I think this is an important thing.
We agree.
And And we as legal people, or you guys as real legal people, and me as a once upon a time legal person, need to keep in mind that this claim that these are people breaking the law or trying to break the law or intending to break the law because they're coming without documents, they're coming to be undocumented, this is the requirement under U.S. law, as international law requires the same thing, that anyone seeking asylum must present themselves at the border of the country where they want to claim asylum and ask for consideration for asylum, precisely what these 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 people that are remaining in the caravan are intending to do. Those that intend to go on to the U.S. and not remain in Mexico, and we don't know how many that is, but they are planning to do precisely what the law says they must do, present themselves at the border. That's not illegal. That's precisely what the law requires. And this notion that they are somehow breaking the law is an outrage. But it was enough to outrage this anti-Semite, this white supremacist, this racist, who took that as evidence that Hayas was somehow involved. He wrote that they are helping people come who are going to kill our people, presumably meaning white Christian people. And he then went on to say, I don't care about the optics, I'm going in. And that was the last thing he wrote just a couple of hours before he went in to murder people in the synagogue.
Trump is characterizing these desperate peoples fleeing from their homes as an invasion. And he says that they're part of them are part of a gang, a drug-related gang. Others are Muslims. He says that with no evidence.
Phyllis, can you talk about how Trump has helped widen the schism between Israeli and American Jews?
Yeah, you know, it's an extraordinary thing. It's one of the memes that you hear sometimes from right-wing pundits and commentators who sort of assert, again, without any evidence. Evidence doesn't seem to be very relevant these days in many arenas, that Trump can't be an anti-Semite because he's the most pro-Israel president there has ever been, as if those two things somehow fit together. The reality is some of the most impassioned supporters of everything Israel does, occupation, apartheid, militarism, killing Palestinians, are supported by some of the most fundamentally anti-Semitic forces in the world. Particularly, I'm thinking here of the Christian Zionist movement, the evangelical Zionists, whose belief is in support of Israel, and for them, Israel can do no wrong. But it's grounded in a theological belief that says that the ingathering of all Jews, not just Israel, but the Zionist project of bringing all Jews to Israel, has to happen before the second coming of Christ. And, wait for it, when the second coming happens, what's going to happen? The Jews will all have to either convert or die. And I've got to say, as a Jew, that's like not such a great choice to want to really face, right?
I'm not taking that choice. But, you know, when,
exactly. And, you know, you ask Israelis about that. Why are you getting support from these people? And they shrug because most Israelis, I mean, probably 70% or more, are not particularly religious. They're pretty secular. So they shrug and they say, we know it's all nonsense. We're going to take support from anyone we can get it from. And if these guys are willing to support us, we don't care what they believe. Well, the problem is that it's a fundamentally anti-Semitic approach to the world that says the only value of Jews is to die. So, you know, others have said that before and have tried to make it real, and this latest assassin is obviously of similar ilk. But this notion of Israeli support from Trump somehow being evidence that he's not an anti-Semite, of course, does not hold water. Beyond that, you have this very personal claim that because his son-in-law is an Orthodox Jew and his daughter converted to Judaism when she married him and they're raising their kids as Orthodox Jews, that's all completely irrelevant to, not to their views of Israel, but it's completely irrelevant to Israeli policy and the historic linkage between, particularly since 1967, in the creation of the so-called special relationship between the United States and Israel. If you go back much further to the origins of Israel. The founders of Zionism in the 1880s and 90s, particularly Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism, whose book The Jewish State is what kind of gave rise to it all, he was very clear throughout his book, this is not about religious Zionism. This has nothing to do with the prayer that Jews say once a year that says, next year in Jerusalem, which is a sort of religious notion. It's not a real estate contract. And for the founders of Zionism, they wanted nothing to do with the religious part. They saw their project as, in the words of Herzl, something colonial. That was the basis on which he tried to get support from Cecil Rhodes, the infamous British colonialist in Africa, was on the basis that our projects are both something colonial. So, you know, you don't have an actual tie there. What you see now is that the positions that Trump is taking in the U.S. domestically, which are so overtly reactionary, so overtly racist, the attacks on immigrants, the whole range of right-wing sort of memes that Trump has created, these are not supported by the majority of Jews in the U.S., who tend to be liberal to progressive on most issues, with the exception of their views towards Israel and Palestine. And that's what's changing dramatically. Views towards Israel-Palestine among the Jewish community is changing faster than probably anywhere else. So what you see now is this serious divide between Trump as the great hero of pro-Israel forces, and increasingly those pro-Israel forces in the U.S. don't include the majority of Jews the way they want them to. And this is a serious divide that's underway in the Jewish community. And it also divides, as you say, the Jewish community in the United States and the Jews of Israel, the 80% of the Israeli population who are Jewish, who are the dominant beneficiaries of Israeli state policy, which is by law required now to privilege Jewish communities, exclusionary Jewish communities, over any non-Jews, which expressly says in the law that the right of self-determination belongs only to Jews and not to non-Jews. This is not something that is accepted widely among American Jews. It's condemned broadly. In Israel, this new law has enormous popularity, and Trump, including the most overt actions he's taken, moving the embassy, recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, supporting Israel's actions against Palestinians, threatening to arrest officials of the International Criminal Court because the Palestinians are trying to go to the court to hold Israel accountable for its potential war crimes. All of those things are welcomed among Israeli Jews, and many of those things make many American Jews cringe. So there is this growing divide, which precedes Trump, for sure. Trump didn't invent this divide. This shift in discourse in the U.S. over Israel-Palestine among American Jews has been underway for 20 years or more, but it has hastened. It has speeded up since Trump took office. So in that sense, it's a very identifiable moment.
Phyllis, Donald Trump told reporters that armed guards might have saved lives in the synagogue massacre. How do you respond to that?
This is one of the horrifying responses that we're hearing more and more frequently in response to these all-too-frequent mass shooter, mass casualty attacks. The notion that somehow an individual, with or without training, with or without positioning, with or without good eyesight, for that matter, somehow just anybody with a gun, any old person with any old gun, would have kept people safe, absolutely flies in the face of what we know about the ability to use arms to go after an armed shooter. When they're taken out by police, most of the time more victims result before the perpetrator is finally killed or immobilized. The notion that just anybody should be there, and we're now seeing responses. The the president of the borough president of Brooklyn, who's a former New York City cop, announced a couple of days ago that from now on he would not enter a church, a synagogue, or a mosque without carrying his weapon, something he's apparently allowed to do as a retired cop, but that would be somehow something that would either keep him safe or his family safe. It's not clear who he thinks he's going to be keeping safe. But I must say it made me very nervous at the prospect of going into any house of worship in New York if he's going to be carrying weapons wherever he goes.
Well, I think that the way to approach it, and I want to ask you what you think, but the way to approach our safety is, first of all, you got to outlaw AR-15s. Those are weapons that are only designed to kill people. They're not even hunting weapons. But I think, moreover, there's a social crisis here that has to be addressed, and that's not what's being discussed. Chris Hedges was on our show 2 weeks ago, and he said, and I didn't know this statistic, 40% of the American people make less than $12 an hour. When you have a social crisis like that, and you have people in despair, that's the engine of fascism. Using scapegoats like Jews or Muslims or gays is what fascism has historically done, and we see it accelerating. I don't think people anticipated that politics in the United States would get so bad so quickly. What's your thinking about what we have to do?
Well, I think you raise all the right questions, Michael. The statistic that Chris Hedges, I guess, mentioned, it's also something that our colleagues in the Poor People's Campaign have been talking about a lot, that 140 million people in the United States are either living below the poverty level or just above it, to the point where a $400 unexpected expense, your kid falls off the monkey bars and breaks his arm, you know, that sort of thing, would be enough to force people into poverty, that they could easily, from that, lose their car and thus be unable to get to work, lose their job, and lose their house as the result of a $400 bill. And that the fact that such a huge proportion, 43% of the population of this country, faces that, is something that we in the privileged enclaves of the coasts, if you will, don't necessarily see day to day. We see poverty, but at the, what you might say, at the retail level, not at the wholesale level, in whole communities, rural communities, smaller towns, where serious poverty is facing a huge component of the United States population. And what that speaks to, those who benefit from fascism, and indeed those who actually started, I think historically, have not been the poorest, but they are a target of those who would build that kind of a movement, that kind of a far-right movement based on this kind of scapegoating. And we know that anti-Semitism goes back hundreds and hundreds of years as one of the key motivating factors of white supremacy. You know, the fact that in Charlottesville, at the when the Klan was marching with their torches, what they were chanting was, "Jews will not replace us. Jews will not replace us." It was an explicit call to anti-Semitic violence. But it does speak to a particular history that anti-Semitism plays as the centerpiece of a certain kind of white nationalism and white supremacy, because Jews as a minority go back so many hundreds of years in so many different countries. So it is playing that role, and when we see it playing out with this level of violence, it was something that Dr. King, that Dr. Martin Luther King said, that we quoted in the article that I did with Reverend William Barber from the Poor People's Campaign and Repairers of the Breach. It was a quote from Dr. King's obituary, or his eulogy for the four girls that were killed in the Birmingham church bombing in 1964. And the quote says that those little girls, quote, have something to say to every politician who has fed his constituents with the stale bread of hatred and the spoiled meat of racism. They say to us that we must be concerned not merely about who murdered them, but about the system, the way of life, the philosophy that produced that murderer.
Yeah,
I think that's a very prescient approach, that it's important that we identify what led this murderer to kill 11 people in this synagogue. But it's even more important that we identify what in our country, what is the culture in our country that is giving rise to armed forces like this murderer. Where did he get these ideas? Who in the White House is he listening to? Who in the mass media is he listening to? What are his teachers telling him? All of these things. And that's where we get to the question of solidarity, that it's not enough for Jews alone to stand up and say this. This means that we stand with the people that were murdered just last week in the Kroger supermarket in Kentucky. After the gunman failed to get into the black church he was trying to get into, he instead went into a grocery store and killed two customers, two African-American customers. The same with the people who were killed in 2015 at the Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, where nine people were killed, again, in a house of worship with a gun. The people that were killed at the Pulse nightclub because they were gay. What we're seeing and what we need to build on is precisely that level of solidarity that is coming from all those communities, recognizing how all of us are unsafe as long as any of us are unsafe, and that our safety is bound up with everybody else's, that the defense, the protection of Jewish communities or Jewish synagogues is not going to be found with somebody with a gun sitting in the entry. It's going to be found with building those ties of solidarity with the mosque down the street and the church up the block and the secular centers of human life that we all participate in. That's what's going to keep us safe.
Phyllis Bennis, I think we should end with those thoughts. And Heidi and I thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
An important victory against gerrymandering was recently won in the state of Pennsylvania in the case of the League of Women Voters versus the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. The first paragraph of the complaint lays it all out. It reads, "This case is about one of the greatest threats to American democracy today, partisan gerrymandering. A partisan gerrymandering occurs when the political party in control of redistricting redraws congressional or state legislative districts to enrich that party in power and prevent voters affiliated from electing candidates of their choice. The result is that general election outcomes are rigged. They are predetermined by partisan actors sitting behind a computer and not by the voters." In Pennsylvania, although the Democrats have more supporters than the Republicans have 13 seats in the U.S. Congress and the Democrats have only five. The U.S. Supreme Court has not been willing to rule on gerrymandering, taking the position, as enunciated by Justice Scalia, that there is no clear way to determine if there has been gerrymandering, and therefore it's a non-judiciable issue. To get around this, in 2018, Pennsylvania activists engineered a brilliant legal effort in the state courts of Pennsylvania to attack the lopsided redistricting, and they won after fighting pitched battles all the way up to the state Supreme Court. Now activists around the country can do the same. The next congressional redistricting occurs after the 2020 census. Progressives need to be ready well before then. We speak today with constitutional litigator James R. Lieber, who has provided a real-time report on effective trial lawyers working to facilitate the will of the people. He explains the strategies of counsel and the evidence presented and has provided a roadmap to social justice litigants for pursuing constitutionally protected claims in state court based on the state constitution and avoiding federal review. Attorney James B. Lieber is the author of three previous books and a lawyer who is focused on constitutional, civil rights, and discrimination cases. We will talk to him about his recently published book put out by Orr Books called Victory, How Pennsylvania Beat Gerrymandering and How Other States Can Do the Same. Attorney Jim Lieber, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Michael.
After the 2010 census, the Republicans in Pennsylvania gerrymandered the state. It was pretty gross, wasn't it? Can you describe what some of the new districts that they cooked up looked like?
Yes. I mean, they're famously skewed and distorted. The most famous is the 7th Congressional District, and it was described as goofy, kicking Donald Duck. And it kind of looks like that. That's also on the cover of my book. But in places, the district's no wider than a restaurant or some type of health clinic. Well, there's others. I mean, there's one that looks like a jockey riding a sea serpent. There's another one that looks like it's been described as an antelope going downhill on a sled. I mean, they're crazy, and the Republican map maker operative who developed these districts has described them as modern art. They're very unusual shapes, not seen in nature.
No, I mean they're supposed to be not exactly a circle, but they're supposed to have some inherent connection. When I saw them, I couldn't believe it. It reminded me of a Rorschach test.
Well, it reminds other people that too, and it's just a game to make the districts permanently, in Pennsylvania at least, elect 13 Republicans and 5 Democrats out of the 18 in the congressional delegation.
How sophisticated were the Republicans when they drew these maps? I mean, how do you do it with computers? I mean, how do you figure out how to screw over the other party?
Well, it is an extremely sophisticated process. It's related to GPS, and the amount of data available for doing this is quite sophisticated and gets down to the what's called the census tract level. I think there's about 400,000 census tracts in Pennsylvania. It's just a matter of a couple of blocks usually, and they can be pincered from one district to another. We know a lot about them and who votes in them and how they vote, or at least the Republicans do. And there's a lot of sales and marketing and other types of personal information out there that get built into their algorithms. So it's extremely sophisticated. It's often referred to as micro-targeting. It's extremely cynical. It's extremely secretive. I mean, this is a process that affects everyone, but when the Republicans in the state legislature in Pennsylvania did it, it was all hush-hush behind closed doors. The districts were not revealed until 14 hours before the vote, and due to a very effective Republican effort, they had across the country, they had won so many state legislative seats that they had the majorities in both houses in Pennsylvania, and it went forward over great objections once people saw what was the problem. And fortunately, really dedicated activists and I would say brilliant attorneys grabbed this issue and realized that they could not bring it up under the federal constitution, but they could bring it up under the very venerable Pennsylvania constitution.
Yeah, it's older than the American constitution. I want to get there, but first let me ask you, as a practical measure, how did this redistricting impact people? Say somebody who needed to get medical benefits or educational benefits. I mean, your average person in Pennsylvania was affected by this, wasn't he?
Yes, yes. They were profoundly affected. What they found was that their communities, which in this process are called communities of interest, were completely broken up, were not represented. The Republicans who got safe seats had little contact with the Democrats, or particularly people. I mean, they could just disfavor the extension, the preservation of health care benefits, or many or environmental concerns, or in some ways, the one that is coming to mind to me, because I'm calling you from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, some type of gun or weaponry control. I think that as we face this election, it will be possible, should be possible, for the House of Representatives to switch. It certainly will be very different in Pennsylvania. It won't be 13-5. I think that a Democratic House would take up the assault rifle issue.
Well, it was the assault rifle that Bowers used to murder 11 elderly Jews in the synagogue last week.
That's correct.
I wanted to ask you, Jim, who were the plaintiffs that tried to protect themselves against this gerrymandering? Tell us about the plaintiffs, please.
Well, they were. I hate to use the term ordinary people. I mean, they were, in some ways, they were ordinary, but they were all Democrats. There was one from each of the 18 congressional districts. They were from different walks of life. Not all of them testified for the plaintiffs. Only three did, and the rest submitted affidavits. One was from Western Pennsylvania, was a reservist in the military and a teacher of social studies. One from Eastern Pennsylvania was a 74-year-old African American woman who was a, as it turns out, a chaplain in a long-term care facility or nursing home. And then there was one from the Reading area, and he was a general practice attorney. They were all interested in various issues that their Republican congressional representatives weren't interested in. The African American woman was from the city of Chester, which is a poor city with a lot of gun violence, and they couldn't get their representative even to come to a meeting once Chester got tacked on to the 7th District. The gentleman from the Reading area was very concerned with immigration. They have an ICE facility there, a detention center there, and of course they couldn't get any response, as far as I can tell, from the congressman. And I want to say, under the 2010 redistricting plan, they were all congressmen in Pennsylvania, and a district of 18, no women. It's extraordinary in this day and age. Now we have, I think, about 7 women who are positioned to win, or be close anyhow.
We're speaking with Jim Lieber, yeah, who wrote the just-published book, Victory, How Pennsylvania Beat Gerrymandering and How Other States Can Do the Same. Book was published by Orr Books, and shout out to John Oakes, who shepherded the project through. Jim, tell me about the lawyers in this lawsuit.
It was a team effort, and an extraordinary team effort between a group called the Public Interest Law Center, which is based in Philadelphia, and a very venerable, powerful Washington law firm called Arnold and Porter K. Scholer, from which former Supreme Court Justice Abe Fortas emanated. He practiced there. He formed the firm, actually. These people did a remarkable job. And disadvantage, Michael, with regard to state constitutional litigation is, if you win, unlike in federal courts, there's no provision for shifting attorney's fees to the other side, which is one of the reasons why we've always many of us civil rights and constitutional lawyers have always favored federal courts. So this was an extraordinary volunteer effort. And I would say, no question in my mind, that probably over $1 million in attorney's fees were expended.
Wow. Well, let me ask you the next logical question. Why did they go into state court?
Well, there are a lot of reasons for that. The United States Supreme Court has, over the years, been becoming more conservative and narrower about civil rights, including voting rights, especially including voting rights in some ways. And some of the decisions signaled that the Supreme Court would not, in fact, take up this issue or disrupt the statewide system. That, of course, happened in Gill versus Wisconsin, the case that the United States Supreme Court decided, I believe, in June. And it signaled the previous summer that it would not grant relief to the aggrieved voters in that case by not staying the stopping the Wisconsin gerrymandered system. As soon as that happened, probably within weeks of each other, when the Pennsylvania petitioners went into state court in Pennsylvania.
They were able to rely on the Pennsylvania Constitution. Talk about that, please.
Yes, the Pennsylvania Constitution is more expansive in terms of rights than the U.S. Constitution. The Pennsylvania Constitution has been amended a few times, but it derives from 1776, the year of the Declaration of Independence. Benjamin Franklin presided over it. It's a very humane, exciting document about human rights. The United States Constitution is pretty vague about voting rights, but the Pennsylvania Constitution has an important clause, happens to be Article 1, Section 5. It's called the Free and Equal Clause, and I can read it for a moment. It's short, but elections shall be free and equal, and no power, civil or military, shall at any time interfere to prevent the free exercise of the right of suffrage. It's a powerful clause. Now, there were other claims. One was under the Pennsylvania First Amendment, the Pennsylvania Constitution. Another was under the Pennsylvania Equal Protection Clause. But the justices of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court didn't have to reach those two. They just decided the case on the Free and Equal Clause. It was a pretty easy decision for them, because as Justice Deborah Todd said in really a great magisterial 140-page opinion, the votes of the petitioners were nugatory. They really didn't count, and that's because they were gerrymandered into insignificance.
Who testified for the plaintiffs, and what evidence did they present? What did they say?
Well, in addition to the three people I talked about, the soldier teacher, the chaplain at the nursing home, and the general practitioner lawyer, what they basically talked about was that their districts had been cracked and packed into insignificance. Now, those are terms that are used in the redistricting, micro-targeting, gerrymandering trade to make districts not work, to not represent the will of the people in the communities. You split off portions of them and add them to maybe rural, very Republican communities. Or they can be packed with to render them nullified by neighborhoods in opposing communities. So they testified to that, and how that maybe even the hearts of their districts, like in one case the city of Reading, which had always been part of a congressional district, the heart of it, the county seat, a pretty major town, city, just was split off and put somewhere where the voters there, who are Democrats for the most part, just wouldn't really count. This was a case of major expert testimony, very complex in some ways, mathematical testimony, and I hope I've been able to explain the meaning of it, because the plaintiffs, or the petitioners, had extraordinary social scientists, quantitative social scientists, testing whether the compositions of the district, which were so skewed mathematically, were random or not, and found that no, the chances of them being random were, in most cases, less than a tenth of a percent.
Yeah, I know. I read that. I couldn't believe it. We're speaking with Jim Lieber, who just had published his excellent book called Victory, How Pennsylvania Beat Gerrymandering and How Other States Can Do the Same. Jim, how did the Republicans defend what seems to me indefensible? What did they say in support of their position?
Well, Michael, the thing is that they said that under the U.S. Constitution, which wasn't fundamentally at issue, that legislatures get to do what they want to do, state legislatures, with regard to redistricting. They really couldn't defend with regard to the notion that that has to be measured against the state constitution standards. They presented some experts. The experts that the Republicans presented were quite deficient, I thought, and so did the trial judge.
I read that.
Yeah, he found them not credible.
Yeah.
In terms of their quantitative analysis. Some of the things that they had to say, quite frankly, made no sense. And so they raised this issue of legislative prerogative, and they had their social scientists. That was their defense.
So how can this be used in other states?
It can be used broadly. It can be used under state constitutions that are very similar to the Pennsylvania Constitution. Many states have a free and equal clause. All of these states really developed from a kind of a benign, rights-oriented, Enlightenment-era constitutional era.
Well, Jim Lieber, thank you so much for being our guest on Law and Disorder. Thank you for writing Victory, How Pennsylvania Beat Gerrymandering and How Other States Can Do the Same. It's been great having you on the show. We wish you good luck, and we hope that what's happened in Pennsylvania happens all over the place. You take it easy, Jim.
Thank you, Michael. It's been great.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.